If you would open your Bibles to Hebrews chapter 11. We continue our focus on the Faith Hall of Fame found in Hebrews chapter 11. And we pick up tonight looking at verse 20 and going down through verse 31. And we're not going to read all of these, but I do want us to hit some of the highlights of what's being said in this particular section of Hebrews chapter 11. As I look at passages, I try to look for themes or common things that are there because, first of all, it helps it make sense to me and I think can help it make sense to others. As I look at this particular section, one of the things that jumped out to me was the common theme was each of the people here were facing death. They were either facing the reality of their own impending departure from this life or the possibility or threat thereof. And when you're facing a situation at the end of your life, it's a time when folks generally really reflect on what matters to them. And it's in those moments we find out how we really view the future. Things that we've put off, things that we've ignored, things we've done nothing about, suddenly we're faced with in those moments. I'm reminded of a couple of families lately who had loved ones who were facing this moment. Loved ones who needed to make decisions in their lives, needed to make changes, needed to make their lives right with God. And they knew that their time for leaving this life was coming. And their family members in both cases talked to them about the fact that in reality they had a gift, they had a blessing. For they had the blessing of knowing that their death was coming. Which meant they had an opportunity to reflect upon their lives, an opportunity to reflect upon their relationship with God, and an opportunity to make their lives right with God if they were wrong. And in both cases, they did just that and renewed their relationship with God because they realized, looking back, that they had not been faithful to God for many, many years. As you think about that, I want you to realize at the end of this sermon, we're going to offer an invitation. And as we sing that invitation song, I want each of us to think about that we may not be able to know when that moment for our departing this life may come. We have no guarantee that we will have the opportunity that these two men and these two families had to look at life and to make changes that we needed to have made a long, long time ago. For us, it may come suddenly. For us, it may come and it may be too late to make changes. As we look at our lives tonight, if any of us see there need to be changes, if we see that we've never accepted Christ in baptism. We believe that Jesus is God's Son. We've just never acted upon that. We've never expressed it in repentance, confession, and baptism. It is my prayer and that invitation song, you'll come forward. In fact, if you need to do that, it won't hurt my feelings if you don't wait till the invitation song. If you'll come right down front, at any point tonight, one of our elders will come and talk to you, and they'll do whatever God calls on us to do to make your life right with God. And for those of us who are Christians that realize we've not been what God wants us to be and we need to make some changes, if those are privately, then let's make them. If they're public changes that need to be made, things that need to be made right in a public way, whatever it is, let's make it right. Because we have no guarantee that we'll get a second chance when it comes our moment. But as we look at this particular set of verses, each of these people were facing the end of their life or threat of the loss of life for themselves or for their children. And in those moments, they had to make some decisions about whether they would trust God. I want us to think about three points to ponder tonight as we focus on blessing, as we focus on beauty, and as we focus on broken. Blessing, beauty, and broken. If we look starting in Hebrews chapter 11 in verse 20, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau, even regarding things to come. By faith Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. And by faith Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. There the Hebrew writer is alluding to events that are found in Genesis 48, 49, and 50. And he's basically dealing with the final words of Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Things they said to their families, in the case of the first two, blessings that they pronounced on their children as they were facing the end of life. It's interesting as he talks about by faith, Isaac gave a blessing to his sons. You may remember that at the time he gave the blessing to Jacob and Esau, you may remember he was tricked. But it seems that Isaac came to believe, even though he was tricked into giving the firstborn and leadership blessing to Esau, or Jacob instead of Esau, he came to believe that that was the will of God. That that was the will of God not only for him, but that was the will of God for his sons, and that God would fulfill those blessings in their lives. In other words, he made those blessings and stuck to the blessings that he made because he trusted in the faithfulness of God and that God would work in the lives of his children just as he had promised to work in the life of Isaac himself. If you look at Genesis 48 and 49, you've got a description of the blessings that Jacob gave to his sons. In chapter 48, the blessing of Joseph and his two boys, Ephraim and Manasseh. And then chapter 49, the blessing he gave to all the sons. In a real sense, a lot of these blessings are prophecies of things that are going to happen, not just so much to the sons, but that are going to happen to the tribes, the people who are going to be their descendants and come out of them. And in that you see a vision of trust in God. That, for example, it says in 48 of Genesis that he blessed the sons of Joseph. And as he blessed the sons of Joseph, he believed that God was going to give a double portion of blessing to Joseph. And basically what Jacob does is he takes the two sons of Joseph and he adopts them as his sons. They were his grandsons, but Jacob adopts them as his sons and gives them an equal portion of the inheritance with their uncles. And as a result of that, it means that Joseph's family line got a double portion of the inheritance that came forth from Jacob. And it talks about the fact that as his life ended, he was worshiping and praising God. My point is in that, not only that he blessed and that he worshiped, it's interesting also that again he reversed the order of the sons. Instead of it being Manasseh and Ephraim, he gave the first blessing to Ephraim and then to Manasseh. And later on, the northern tribes were at times by the prophets be called Ephraim because they were largely, the largest portion of them came from Ephraim and the descendants of Joseph. But what I want us to see in that is the same thing we saw in Isaac. These blessings they pronounced on their children were based on faith in the promises of God and faith that God would carry out those promises and work in their descendants after them. He then talks about Joseph and how in chapter 50, Joseph at the end of his life is giving directions to his brothers. And as he's talking to his brothers, he basically says, when you leave this place, when your descendants go up from here to the land God has promised you, I want you to take my bones with you. In other words, as he faced the end of life, he believed, based on the promises of God, that God's people were never intended to stay in Egypt. It was a place they had to go to for a time to survive the famine. And God put Joseph there to be an instrument of their salvation. But the promise was not the land of Egypt. The promise from God was the land of Canaan. And he believed that God would fulfill that promise. And he says, I want you to take my bones back home. Now that's interesting, because he had spent most of his life in Egypt. I mean, if you look at the chronology of his life, Egypt is more home than Canaan. He only lived in Canaan 17 years. But that was home because that was the land of promise. My point is, in all three of these cases, I think the Hebrew writer is saying, when they gave blessings and directions to their descendants, their blessings and their directions were based on belief that God would continue to work in His people and trust that God would fulfill His promises to them and do what He said He would do. He then moves from them and moves forward in time to a man named Moses. And he looks at four, possibly five major events that connect to his life. We will look at four in this particular section. And what he does is he begins by focusing on the parents of Moses and decision they made when Moses was but a child. Amram and Jochebed brought forth a baby boy in a time when there was an edict from Pharaoh that all baby boys were to be put to death. The Israelites had become a threat to Egypt. And so because of a fear that the Israelites would become large and powerful and raise up their own army, they started putting to death the boys, because the boys were the ones that usually went to war. And they didn't want an army that could defeat them right in the middle of them. So they started killing the boys. But the text says that the parents of Moses looked at him and saw that he was beautiful. Now, we may have different opinions on that, and I don't know that my opinion's the right one, but I'll tell you how I look at that. Now, some folks may look at that and say, oh, they thought he was really pretty, so they didn't kill him. If they didn't think he was pretty, then maybe they would have let the Pharaoh's soldiers put him to death. I don't believe that's what he's talking about. If you go to Acts chapter 7 and verse 20, there it says of Moses that he was lovely in the sight of God. Here's what I think that expression, that he was beautiful, means. I believe, from what I can tell from some reading, is that sometimes that idea was used in a sense that a person's life is beautiful or lovely because God's face shines upon them. That the God's work and God's grace and God's presence can be seen in their lives. My belief is, for what it's worth, is that in Hebrews 11, what he's trying to say is that Moses' parents believed that there was something special about their boy. They believed that there was something of God, that he was lovely in the eyes of God, that God had something special planned for him. And based on that, they would not turn him over to the soldiers, but they chose to hide him. And when they could hide him no longer, they put him in a basket in the river and basically entrusted him to the watchful eye, not of his older sister so much who stood by, but to the watchful eye of God, the Creator of the universe. In other words, they had to make a decision when they were faced with the possible imminent death of their son. And they decided God has plans for this boy's life. You know, as we think about the discussion of abortion in our country that has become so rampant, I think the words of a song so many years ago I heard that said, "What was I supposed to be?" Speaking in the song from the terms of a child whose life was aborted, the child says, "You know, was I going to be a doctor, a preacher, somebody could impact the world? What would I have been if they'd only let me live?" Oh, if but all parents could see their children in terms of what God could do with their lives, then I think child abuse would disappear. I think abortion would disappear. I think the taking of the lives of children would disappear if we could but see them as beautiful and lovely in the eyes of God, people whom God can use to change the world. And so it was that the parents of Moses saw something beautiful in him, and they put trust in God that God would deliver him from death, and that is exactly what God did. He goes on to say that by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And it talks about that he chose rather to be ill-treated with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin. That Moses made a choice that was really beautiful to him, was being one of God's people. It wasn't the treasures of Egypt. It wasn't the learning of Egypt. It wasn't the power of Egypt. I remember a lesson I heard a few years ago by Jordan Guy. And he said basically this. He said, Moses chose God over position, pleasure, possessions, and punishment. And I think that's a pretty good description. Moses made a decision what was really beautiful to him. And he said, what was beautiful is what God has. It wasn't what the Egyptians had. And he made a decision to make a change, a course correction, if you will, in his life. And when he chose to side with God's people, his life came under threat again. When he stood up against that Egyptian taskmaster that sought to take the life of a Hebrew slave, then he became a person on the list of Pharaoh's most wanted, and his life was a threat and in jeopardy. When he was faced with that decision, the text of Hebrews is saying he put his faith and trust in God. He believed that God would deliver him. He believed as he ran out into the desert and left all he had known behind that God would take care of him and all would be okay. It then goes on to talk about how Moses, having led the children of Israel out of Egypt or preparing to lead them out of Egypt, it talked about how they observed the Passover. It says in verse 28, it says, "By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them." In other words, it's been talking to this moment about the fact that Moses decided he wanted God's beauty over the beauties of Egypt, that he would believe in God over the power of Egypt. And then when God sent him back to lead the children of Israel to safety out of slavery, it says they observed the Passover. Now, I want you to remember, what was the Passover all about? Okay, he told them to observe the Passover. I believe it is in Exodus chapter 12. Okay, they have not been delivered yet. The firstborn have not been delivered yet. They've not left Egypt yet. They've not crossed the Red Sea yet. They were told to observe the Passover in anticipation of what God was going to do. And so what he's basically saying is, when they observed the Passover and when they put the blood on the doors of their houses, what it was saying is that they trusted that God would deliver them in the future. When they did that, they were still slaves. When they did that, they were still in Egypt. And when they did that, they did so under the threat of the death angel taking the lives of the firstborn. And every single person that night, Egyptian or Hebrew, who did not put the blood on the door, who did not commemorate that Passover, every single firstborn would lose their life. In other words, as they faced death at the hands of the death angel, Moses put his trust in God and was able to look beyond Egypt, beyond slavery, to beyond the dangers of that night, to the deliverance that God had promised. The final section, it focuses really on Israel, and then more specifically, it's going to talk about Rahab. As it talks about Israel, you kind of have a connection verse moving from Moses to Israel in general. And it says that by faith, they went through the Red Sea. By faith they were delivered. By faith they trusted that God would deliver them. They were afraid. They were terrified. They looked back and saw the Egyptians pursuing them, but they still went through the sea. The Hebrew writer is not trying to say they didn't have any fears. The Hebrew writer is not saying they didn't ever have any moments of doubt. But the Hebrew writer is saying that along the way, God's people overcame those things and did what God asked them to do and put their ultimate faith and trust in God. And so as they faced death at the hands of the Egyptian on the borders of the Red Sea, they trusted God and crossed over. When they came into the land of promise and they stood outside the walls of Jericho with death and battle just across the divide between the city and the people, with impending war coming, they chose to do what God said to do. They put aside all their battle plans. They put aside what other armies might have done. And they did what God said to do. And they marched around those walls once a day. Until that seventh day, they marched around it seven times. And they shouted and they blew their trumpets. And the walls came down. When faced with death at the hands of their enemies, they trusted that God would break the might of those who were their foes. They trusted that God would break the walls that stood before them. And it's interesting that he finishes with Rahab. Because his theme all the way through this, as you look at the folks he's mentioned and gone into detail to talk about, these are all folks who served God before the children of Israel got full possession of the promised land. They were all people in search of something. They were all people in need of a people, a land, and a home. And what better example than Rahab? A woman who inside the walls of Jericho was faced with imminent death as the army of God encircled those walls. She had heard what God had done through Israel to the Egyptians.
She had heard what God had done through Israel to the Ammonite kings on the other side of the Jordan River. She feared what God was about to do through Israel to her city. And she made a decision. When she stood at death's door, she made a decision that she would trust that God would preserve her house when the walls of Jericho came tumbling down. Each of these people, either facing the end of life and pronouncing blessings, facing threat of death for their children or for themselves at the hands of kings and great armies, each of them had to make decisions. And what the Hebrew writer is saying is that when they had to make a decision, they chose to trust God. And what he's emphasizing is they put their trust in God even when they could not see the immediate fulfillment of what they were trusting in on the horizon. As we look at these three sections, we find, first of all, that Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph trusted that God would bless their descendants. And so they blessed their children accordingly. Moses and his parents trust in the beauty of God and the strength of God more than the beauty and power of Pharaoh in Egypt. Israel and Rahab trusted that God would break their enemies, that God would break the army of Egypt, that God would break the army of Jericho, and in the end, God broke the army of idolatry and took a woman who had lived a life serving false gods, statues of wood and stone. And she became a woman who would influence the history of Israel. And here we are thousands of years later, still speaking her name. I want you to think about the change in that one life. She was a prostitute. She was living a life of immorality and idolatry. But that life was touched by God. And when faced with death, she decided to trust God. And here we are, thousands of miles and thousands of years later, speaking of her name and calling one another to be like her. Each of these folks looked beyond death, looked beyond the circumstances in front of them, and trusted God. Now, why is the Hebrew writer talking about all these people? Because again, he's writing to people who are struggling. He's writing to people who are being persecuted. And what he's saying is that each of these people were faced with struggles and circumstances, but they were able to look beyond them because they trusted in God's promises. So he's saying to everybody reading this letter, you look beyond these promises. I have in a blue folder up here, need a few more corrections, but the culmination of 27 years of education over a 40-year span. 9 different schools, who knows how many different teachers. Every school, every teacher, every class along the way forms a chain that connects the very first morning Harding Academy down in Huntsville, Alabama, to the very last day. Teachers like Miss Mercer or Mr. Rogers or Miss Atcher or Mr. Huckabee or Mr. Smith, or Conley, or Holland, or Briley, or Wilder, or Pettigrew, all in a chain that bring me to where I am now. And why do I say that? Because there are many chains in our lives. All of us are the result of chains that brought us where we are. People who have touched us, people who have impacted us, and especially people who brought a chain, a history, a heritage of faith to us. And as we look at this passage, we focused on verses 20 down through verse 31. But you could look at this whole chapter, but especially verse 8 through verse 31. And you see a chain. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses and his parents. Israel and Joshua and Rahab. What he's saying to these Hebrew folks is this is a heritage of faith. And with Abraham, God made a promise, I will give your descendants a land. And then he ends the chain with a woman who wasn't even one of them, that wasn't even an Israelite, who accepted that promise and was adopted into that nation. And then he says, let me tell you something, Hebrew readers. You're a part of that chain. That chain comes down to you. That heritage of faith has been passed on to you in Christ Jesus. And the question the Hebrews had to ask is, would the chain be broken? Because some of these folks were threatening to give up their faith. And so the question for us tonight is, will the chain be broken in our lives? The promise made to Abraham was not just that he would give a great land. The promise to Abraham in Genesis 12 was that in his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. And Abraham becomes the first link in a chain that comes down to everybody in this auditorium. The question is, will we break the chain? Or will we allow God to finish the task in our lives? If we can help you in your relationship with God, please come as we stand and sing.